And thank you very much, I want to say, for organizing this event. I think it's been very productive, and I'm very happy that I'm here. Thank you. Well, I want to start by, this is something that we already talked about. We already talked about this yesterday with Veronica's presentation. This question about if the dichotomy female-male is exhaustive or not, and what is about that? There's such a binarity in the world or not. So we can answer yes, you know, there's absolute dimorphism between male and female. So yes, we can, you know, this dichotomy is exhaustive, it's good enough. We answer this because we assume or we agree that these natural kinds in the world have rigid boundaries, so that's okay. But we can answer no, and one good reason to say that this dichotomy is not exhaustive is because there are already in nature vague cases, and this is something that already Miranda says, that I'm here thinking about Foster Sterling work. She points out that there are around 1.7 born intersexuals. So all those fuzzy cases, I think, at least should make us think that maybe this dichotomy is not correct, it's not valid, because there are, you know, many different cases that do not fit into that dichotomy. But I don't know if this replay is, you know, worth taking into account. I haven't done a lot of research on that, but I found this research replaying to Sterling, Foster Sterling, saying that there intersexual are not as common, you know, because I think the problem here is with the definition of what is an intersexual. If we consider only problems between, you know, chromosome and genitalia matching, or apparently there are different ways in which we can define what is an intersexual. And Foster Sterling is supposed to be using a very broad definition. So this researcher says, oh, intersexual are not as common, and you know, so some research and some data. So we can say, therefore, you know, if this is true, if we agree with him, it's reasonable to think that the male-female dichotomy is still valid. So there are some vague cases, but not as common as to make us rethink or review our categories. What I wanna do is to focus more on the flexibility or these categories and the natural kinds they refer to, more than in the variability that we can find in the world. So I'm not as interested as, I don't know, Foster Sterling or Sachs in how many intersexuals are there, how many cases we find, you know, are born that we can say that we cannot apply the female-male dichotomy. I'm more interested in how flexible the boundaries of those natural kinds and the categories that we use are. So what I want to say is in agreement with Foster Sterling, actually, that sexuality is a continuum, that it's not a matter of, you know, male or female. And I just call it cyber sexes because I'm, you know, following with the idea of this, you know, the use that Andy Clark makes of, you know, this idea of incorporating technology, and you remember his book called Natural Born Cyborg. So I'm thinking of that kind of cyborg. So instead of, you know, discussing how many intersexual, how many natural cases are there, I want to challenge the rigidity of the sex categories, thinking of our capacity to create new cases by incorporating technology or, in general, external resources. So what I want to propose is, nothing new, but just apply this idea of incorporating external resources and manipulating the boundaries of our bodies, apply that to sex categories, and say that we can create many or different sex exemplars that do not fit into this category. So the conclusion would be that the female main category is not exhaustive because sexuality is flexible. When I talked to a colleague about this idea, and then the first thing that he told me is like, oh, you should read something about Donna Haraway. Donna Haraway, because she uses the word cyber. I had no idea, you know, about that. So I said, okay, maybe it's fair to read something and to see if I'm talking about the same cyber or Andy Clark's cyber is a different cyber or what's the. So I was just reading a little bit about this. And I think if I get Donna Haraway's idea right, her cyber manifesto comes from the idea that many of our natural kind categories are socially constructed, like gender or race, you know, and I think that she also applies that to sex, so that, you know, sex is just another category that we think refers to natural kind, but it's, you know, socially constructed. And she emphasizes that she goes against this idea proposed by some feminists of returning to nature. So she wants to, extend the social environment into, you know, the nature. I don't know if anyone can help me with this, I would be happy because I have not many, I don't know a lot about this. So my proposal is quite the opposite because I want to return to nature. I'm happy with that. What I want to say is that because of the way nature is, flexible and plastic in particular, our body, mind, and environment, because of that, the categories of sex are so flexible. So because natural organisms are plastic and exploit the environment, we should expect that some of our natural kinds to be flexible. They are still natural, not socially constructed. I want to keep that separation on this so far. So by now, they are natural, not social, but flexible. Because I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I was thinking about this distinction between gender and sex, and gender is, you know, because gender is social, therefore it's changeable. Sex is biological, therefore it's fixed. So let's stay in the biological realm, but we can still have, you know, flexibility and plasticity without going to the social. So where does this cyber sex come from? Mainly, I came here from, you know, two bodies of thought. The first one is this thing that happened in biological sciences, that two very rigid or, you know, bright lines in biological sciences got blurry. The first one is the line or the divide between genome and organism as the main vehicle of the genome. So after, you know, the genetic triumphalism, you know, we have come to know more about genes, we have come to know that the phenotype is more than a simply reflection of the genotype. So I'm just quoting from here, but you know, to reflect the opposite, that I'm thinking of the 80s, because everything, you know, the attention or the focus was just the genome. It's like the biological nature of organism must be in the genes. So, the alternative is that we should have a much broader view of the organism, or what is our biological nature. We are not just our genome. And the second divide is the divide between the organism and the environment. And here's thinking of, you know, Turner's proposal of extended phenotype. The idea is that organisms explore their environment and extend sometimes their physiology to adapt, or just to reach or to get their goals. So this is, you know, one line of thought. And the second line of thought is all this, we have been talking already, all of us, about this, that all this research is from the science. I guess that what we are, we as cognitive agents, we humans, is not defined exclusively by features that are internal to our bodies, but you know, we have to take into account the interaction with external environment. So this idea of the embodied embedded cognition program, that the cognitive system is not isolated from the body and the environment, so cognitive processes should be understood as a result of a constant dynamic interaction between brain, body, and environment. Oh, you know, okay. See, sometimes when this is what happens, the images, whatever, it's not that important. The Tetris image. So, okay, some of these ideas from recent cognitive science is that I think we have already talked about this. So I'm going to go quickly to this. The biological organisms rely on external resources to improve their abilities. Yes, no. This famous example of playing Tetris, that we are all the time rotating the soil, even though it seems that we don't need to, right? So look at the soil, identify the shape, decide where to place it, and then you rotate the soil, you know, according to your decision. But when you look at expert players, they are all the time rotating the soil. I remember when I was in high school, I have some colleagues that they were like amazing. They were amazing lady. And I was like, why are they all the time like that? I thought that I was just like, you know, I can do this, you know, whatever I want. But no, actually, it helps. I mean, it helps because the more you rotate the soil, the better you can identify the shape and the better decision you make. So it's not that you first make the decision and then you rotate the soil. It's like you are making the decision as you are rotating. So you are exploiting that, you know, button there. You are not making all the calculation mentally. So this idea, and then the idea of how plastic minds are, and how, when I talk about mind, how we can incorporate into our mental processes, you know, external, it's just a similar idea. External resources, you know, notebooks or our laptops or our cell phones. And I'm also thinking of this sort of idea of how plastic our bodies are. Again, you know, the idea of physiological extensions. This, I don't know if you have heard the work by Turner, this extended phenotype. He talks about these macro termites that they as many other termites, they cannot digest cellulose, but they use some fungi that are there, so that they grow these fungi inside them, you know, their nest, and they outsource the digestion of cellulose to fungi. So it's like they are digesting that outside, and then, oh, now that they have been digested, then I take it. So it's like, you can say it's an extended physiology is an extended, you know, they are extending their digestion out there. All these ideas, you know, Aniglar has this notion of profound embodiment to refer to organisms that are, or the capacity of organisms to incorporate in new bodily, sensory, and cognitive structure. So, you know, Mirko was talking already about, you know, sensory substitution devices and how we are able to. I had some images here. Yeah, I'm not going to explain this thing, but I think also Miranda already talked about this capacity of incorporating into the body schema external resources. This is an example of also from Andy Clark's book. This monkey that, after being trained to move an artificial arm, the cortical representation of the body expanded to incorporate the artificial arm. So it's this plasticity, neuroplasticity, and also, you know, in the body. So it's also happening in the sensory substitution devices, that after training with one of those devices, they start to move around, maybe with this tactile visual substitution, they start to move around as if they are seeing, processing not visual but tactile information. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how plastic, you know, the body, sorry, the the brain can do. So here, I think it's important, and this is something I think I need to explore deeper, is the distinction between use and incorporation. I mean, we don't want to say that we are incorporating a hammer when we are building an IKEA furniture, but we seem to like the idea of, we feel happier thinking that when we are fluently, for example, working with a stick, also from Clara's book, is that we don't think that we are just holding the stick and the stick is, you know, poking that thing that we just found and we don't know what that's in, and we're just like, what's that? It's like we feel that, you know, we are trying to identify that new object, you know, ourselves. We don't feel that we are holding the stick and then the stick is touching the object. We are identifying the object through the stick. So it's kind of a, there are some conditions, of course, that has to be met in order to distinguish between when we are using and we are incorporating. And I think that's crucial. I think Andy Clark had this, he mentioned something like, you have to have a goal. You cannot just incorporate something, you know, arbitrarily. You have to have a goal, and you incorporate a particular tool when you are performing a task in order to get this goal. So, I don't know, I think this is something very important that still have to be discussed, of how, you know, the conditions to incorporate, how many conditions you have to make in order to incorporate versus only use. Oh, well, I think I have enough so far. So the idea would be that in the same way that qua biological organisms we manipulate the limits of our bodies in order to enhance or modify our sensory motor and cognitive abilities, we can also negotiate our sex by manipulating the physiology of our body. So we can incorporate external tools and reinvent our sex. And we can change that anytime we integrate an external element. So this means that this is coming temporal, it's changeable, it's not like long lasting or as long lasting as we want. So I think this is also important to that this is not opposite, but it's not the same that like surgery, for example, intervention or chemical interventions through hormones. So importantly, this would be a consequence, that's what I want, of our natural capacity to constantly negotiate the organism environment boundaries. It's not a consequence of that everything is social, so sex is also social. It's just that how complex and flexible biology is, and this is why, you know, we can manipulate. I'm just thinking of yesterday, Professor Yama said something to me, because like, why not, instead of culture versus biology, or instead of saying that they are complementary, say, why not say that biology includes culture and everything, because by nature, or our nature is to have the ability to create, to manipulate and to negotiate all the boundaries between, you know, the organisms and the environment. So I'm thinking about, you know, that idea. So the proposal, or this is a proposal that has to be tested in particular cases, because it's an empirical question in which cases and to what extent and how incorporation of external structures can be integrated as to, you know, modify or sex or sexuality. I don't want to go into all the schema building discussion, so the idea is that we already have some evidence of extended phenotypes and body schema, the example of this monkey. So it seems, we also have examples of extended cognitive processes when we use, I don't know, different memory aids or, you know, different structure. So the idea is that it seems to me that it can be also true for at least some cases where we manipulate at least some of the traits on which we base our attribution of sex categories. So because we have evidence of, you know, how extended our mind and our bodies are, I think it follows that we can do the same with the sex. So the conclusion would be that the divide between organism and environment is negligible, there's no change. We made a dichotomism not exhaustive, and that there are many possible, as many possible sexes as ways we find to incorporate external resources into our body image or body schema, or both. So if we take embodied embedded mind problem seriously, we can say that in the same way that the cognitive process should not be defined exclusively by inside the head processes, we can say that sexuality should not be defined exclusively by inside the body features. Importantly, changes and manipulation leading to cyber sexes can be external and not intrusive. Changes that take place outside the body, you know, would have the potential to trigger these permissions. You don't have to go on, you know, surgery. So just, you know, taking this from Clark's work, he says something like the boundaries of skin and skull are not the boundaries of the mental. So we can say the boundaries of skin and genome are not the boundaries of sex. Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you.